to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Across from me, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor, is usually with us, but he is on paternity leave as his second child, Elias, was born last week. So we will attempt gamely to fill the gaps with more words from Abe and me on our usual subject, of course, the upcoming presidential election and the interesting news over the last couple of weeks that the race appears to have tightened. One poll taken over the Labor Day weekend, which is not a good time to poll in general holiday weekends, putting Trump in the lead, the first major poll to do so, I think pretty much in this entire cycle, up by 2 points. Two other polls taken around the same time still have Hillary Clinton with a comfortable lead of 5 or 6 points. But the general consensus is that the race has tightened over the last 3 weeks, which makes sense, Abe, I think, because obviously the news has been absolutely terrible for Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump has not called any Mexican judge someone who can't be trusted to hear his lawsuit, or hasn't insulted the Gold Star parents of dead American heroes. So, in general, he's had a better couple of weeks than she has, it would appear.
Yeah, it would be hard not to have. I mean, he could probably, you know, at his best, pull it off, but it would be hard not to have a better couple of weeks than she's had. I mean, you know, part of the issue is that since she's sort of sequestered, her only interface with the American people, she's not out there really speaking to them. It's these headlines, it's these news dumps. That's all that the electorate is sort of getting of her and has been for months.
And her talk about Trump. That is to say, she gave a very powerful speech a couple weeks ago about Trump and the alt-right and the problems therein. But that's all her attacking him. And we again have the classic situation of a front runner playing prevent defense and caution and showing deep caution and not having responses to the extremely bad news that is coming her way in terms of her foundation, in terms of her emails, in terms of what the FBI released, showing all sorts of remarkable things that she said in her interview with them, including that she didn't know what the C in classification meant on documents and that sort of thing. All of which suggests, as I think a lot of people have been saying, that she's either an idiot or a liar, and she's not an idiot. So she's been pretty much exposed as a liar. Not apparently to the degree that the director of the FBI, James Comey, felt it comfortable to indict her on the grounds that she was speaking untruthfully to a federal investigation into her treatment of classified information, but nonetheless pretty much close enough for everybody else.
And, you know, and in some ways it occurred to me that the fact that it sort of can't officially be proven that she's broken laws here is in some sense worse for her, in that the opacity of it and the sort of the suggestion of that this dishonesty and corruption is sort of tolerated, like, oh, if this isn't illegal, then this is the corrupt system that Trump is talking about.
Right. Well, there are only two ways to look at it. One of which is that's right, that it stinks. There's a lot of smoke. It's something bad is going on, but that she managed somehow to get rid of all the information that would reveal what the badness was that she found necessary to delete in those 33,000 emails that she got rid of, and the hammer that was taken to various of her portable devices, and the laptop that mysteriously went missing in the mail, and the fact that a very sophisticated program called BleachBit was used to completely wipe her devices and her emails. And then, of course, the server was broken into pieces and thrown somewhere. And all of this, none of this would lead you to believe anything but that something really horrible was on there that had to be gotten rid of. And when the FBI decided not to indict her, which of course is better than her being indicted, it nonetheless raises all we have now are questions that will never have answers.
And it leaves her living in this poisonous political limbo, you know, where she it sure sounds like she did a lot of bad things, but nothing so bad to take her out of the running. That's just where she's lived. She's just sort of stuck there in that cloud.
Right. Well, you know, a friend of mine yesterday said, who has been watching and covering the Clintons for more than two decades, said that, you know, the big question with the there has been this cloud over the Clintons since 1993, when it became clear that various untoward things had happened in Arkansas, that they had made $100,000 on a $1,000 investment on a land property, there had been billing controversies at her law firm, and the bills and the billing documents had gone missing and then mysteriously were uncovered in the White House in a closet 2 years later. And a totally forgotten thing, which is that when the Clintons wanted to install a friend of theirs, making the travel arrangements at the White House, they fired en masse the public servants, the civil servants who had run this White House travel office, and then somebody attempted to pin a crime on the head of the travel office, Billy Dale, in order basically to cover up for the fact that they were trying to get work, you know, to try to get this contract assigned to a friend of theirs. And when you look at all of this, and this is two decades old, it has nothing to do with the present, but ingrained habits of behavior that start manifesting themselves when you are trying to dissimulate about something that smells, even if it didn't rise to a crime then in 1993, you start sneaking around and acting weird and not behaving on the up and up, and then you trigger all these conspiracy theories on the part of your enemies, and then you have to protect yourself against the falseness of the conspiracy theories and protect yourself in general. And then an entire habit of behavior is created, a cycle of behavior in which she and Bill do things in a certain way that makes them look shady, that sets off their enemies, which in turn then leads their friends to defend them against their enemies. But what Hillary Clinton has done here with these emails and the server and the classified information, all this, is not defensible in any realm. I mean, you can defend it in the sense you could say that it doesn't, if you're a certain type of person, it doesn't disqualify her for being president because she's so wonderful in all sorts of other ways and everybody has flaws. But it's not defensible. She clearly, they behave very badly here at the very least. And I think, when you look at these polls, what you are seeing is people who ought to be supporting her feeling extremely uneasy about supporting her. Trump's number remains around 39, 40, 41. It doesn't move very much. Her number bounces down from 50 to 40, depending on the poll and depending on the moment. And that what that means is that she is leeching support out, because people find what is going on with her distasteful. It's got nothing in some way. This is an entirely, has nothing to do with Trump. This is all about Hillary and the people who ought to be backing her going, she is making me very, very uneasy. You know, I don't know what she does about that.
Well, and then also then, I sort of hate to even propose this as a possibility, but is it possible that Trump has now sort of figured out that he needs to, and that maybe he can stop getting in his own way here and let this just happen to her?
I think it's pretty clear that you have to say that there was some point in the middle of August when he opened his eyes one morning and he said, I'm not going to win this, and in fact, I'm going to be humiliated, so I better take some advice from somebody else and do something differently. Now, he is who he is. He's going to have a lot of unscripted. They're going to have, you know, four and a half hours or 5 or 6 hours of unscripted debate time in which he will be asked unexpected questions that he does not know he'll be getting and in which he'll have to respond to her. And that's when you just don't know how he is going to behave. So that's the key. The key is that he also is in hiding in some sense. I mean, he went to Louisiana and he saw the damage and he went to Mexico and he said whatever he said in Mexico and he gave a speech earlier today about defense policy, but he's not going on Sean Hannity 3 times a week anymore. He's not going on, you know, phoning into Fox and Friends every morning. He is backing off, in part because the news, I think, is so bad for her. But he can't back off forever, just like she can't back off forever. The other interesting aspect of this is, in these polls, we got 42-43% for her, 40% for him. That's 83%. On election day, those numbers have to add up biologically to 100%. The vote will be whoever gets, you know, what percentage out of 100%. And, you know, there aren't, in the end, going to be 18% of the voters who aren't going to vote for either one of them. That's pretty clear. I don't think that the Greens and Evan McMullen and the Libertarians are going to get 18% of the vote between them. So the real question is, can he climb up from this, you know, very difficult 40% number, you know, by to 50 or 48 or something like that? There still seems to be absolutely no path to that in the Electoral College, but, you know, stranger things have happened, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the support that she's hemorrhaging does seem to be going to the Greens and Libertarians, though. I mean, it's not, you know, he's benefiting mostly not from rising, as you said, right, but from her.
Well, that's if you put them in, and then you don't even know whether people will default to them. The whole point is that an unenthusiastic electorate means low turnout. That's the classic thing. If you have, you know, if you have 15-20% of Republicans who don't want to vote for Trump, and you have 10-12% of Democrats who really don't want to vote for Hillary, therefore you will have decreased turnout. Those people aren't going to go to the polls to vote if they find their choices distasteful. And that, again, is where Hillary will end up with a natural advantage, because the Democrats have a magnificently able turnout machine. And as we know, the Trump campaign has built no turnout machine. And the Republican National Committee, who knows whether they have a turnout machine? They have a decent turnout machine for a midterm election in which 90 million people vote. But they have shown themselves pretty incompetent over the last two elections at building a turnout machine for 135 million people. And indeed, it has generally not been the role of the national committees, the party national committees, to generate turnout in the presidential sphere. That is for the campaigns to do. So we know Hillary's built all that out. And so the lower the turnout, the more unenthusiastic the election appears, the more her technical advantages will come to play. That was the story in 2012, as a senior Romney official said to me, you know, the mistake that we made is that we thought that the unenthusiastic Obama voter wasn't going to vote. But the truth is that an unenthusiastic vote counts the same as an enthusiastic vote. So if you have the ability to get the unenthusiastic voter to the polls, that's just as good as having somebody who will drag himself over broken glass to get to the polls. That's 1-to-1. And so far we don't see, there's no reason to think that there is a modality in which the Republicans are going to get those unenthusiastic voters to the polls, but we've seen Democrats do it before. And that was the story in 2012. People forget that the Democrat Party was not an election full of enthusiasm for Obama at all in any way. That was not the story. The story was that he pulled people who in previous elections probably would not have gone to the polls at all, because they told pollsters that they were not that jazzed about voting.
And, you know, I'd read some analysis that suggested that well, actually, maybe this could mean a sort of higher turnout than we expect, because when candidates are so disliked, you want to go to make sure that the one that you don't like doesn't get in. But the kind of distaste people have for, say, Hillary, when she's the more dynamic factor right now, she's the one losing votes. It's not like she's scaring people into making sure she stays out of the White House. It's more if they were leaning towards, you know, holding their nose and voting for her, they can no longer quite do that.
Right, but I mean, none of that doesn't make any sense, because in fact the notion that people will drag themselves over broken glass to vote against somebody is totally unproven. That's not how it works. I mean, you can say that her path to victory involves making sure that serious Democratic constituencies understand the threat that Trump might pose to them, so that they'll be scared and they will, you know, fear will drive them. But, you know, you still have to give people a reason to feel good about going into the voting booth and pulling the lever for the person that they pull the lever for. I think Romney pulled that off, even though he lost. He pulled that off with his performance in the first debate in 2012, when he really appeared presidential, and then Republicans could have the enthusiasm for him that they really felt that they wanted. That was why the Romney team thought that they were winning going into the final weekend, because they knew that they had solidified the Republican vote to 92-93%, that Republicans had become enthusiastic about voting for him. And, you know, the Trump camp, people who like Trump will be enthusiastic about voting for him, but, can the distaste that many people feel for him dissipate over the next 2 months? I mean, I suppose it could. You know, part of the story is that things become, you know, it's just like that detail that you can end up tolerating any horrendous odor if you were in it for more than 45 seconds. Your body will adjust to it. Well, Trump's been out there now for 14, 15 months, and, you know, the horror of what he said and done and the disgusting things that he said and done are now kind of regular. You're kind of used, you know, everyone's become inured to it. It's like the lie of the day, you know, the whatever nonsense that he spews one day after the next, it's like, oh yeah, there he goes. there he goes again. Ha ha ha. It's so funny. You know, even today in this speech he gave on defense, which I think we should talk a little bit about. So he combines sensible, practical policy suggestions that have simply been handed to him on a sheet of paper, meaning it's time to get rid of if we need to grow the size of the military, which he says we do, we need to break the 2011 sequester rules involving defense spending so that there is adequate money to pay for more ships and more military personnel and more planes. And at the same time, he basically gave a speech in which his heartfelt thing that he said is that we should never intervene anywhere, which begs the question, why then do you need a larger and more advanced military? For what conceivable purpose? All of that is for, particularly building a larger navy, that's all for the projection of American power abroad to do the things that he has now declared he does not wish to do.
Well, I suppose you would need this larger military to implement his as yet articulated 30-day ISIS elimination strategy.
Right. Well, he told us last year that he already had a plan to defeat ISIS. So then today he says that it's not clear whether, in fact, the phrasing is very odd. He either wants a plan to defeat ISIS in 30 days or he wants a plan on his desk in 30 days to defeat ISIS. Defeating ISIS in the form in which he describes defeating ISIS will violate every single one of his preconditions about the use of American power. That is, there is no way to defeat ISIS that does not involve boots on the ground and seizing territorial control in Syria and Iraq and throwing them out of the supposed caliphate and removing them and then creating the creating a barrier for them to get back in so that their oil and the money and that their base of operations is eliminated.
And it cannot be done in 30 days, if that was, in fact, the 30 days he was talking about. And it would involve all the kinds of political investment in a far off land that he says he's opposed to. It would involve dealing with the Assad regime. It would involve making sure that all these other groups, and not just Nusra, but all the next jihadists don't pop up and resume the fight, because Syrians are continued to be more upset about Assad than ISIS.
Right, which is the important thing here. I mean, these details are very hard to, you know, get in the weeds. I mean, you start mentioning different groups and the complicated sets of arrangements that are going on in Syria against ISIS. But if you are committed, if your policy, your sole policy in the world is the destruction or the removal of ISIS as a cancer on the planet, it commits you to certain forms of behavior that in some ways are more extreme, more dangerous, and more full of more potential unintended consequences than the ones that he has washed his hands of, like, you know, Iraq and Libya, both of which he supported and now claims that he didn't support. So that's the nagging fact. Like, you know, one knows that Obama knows now that... there is no eliminating ISIS without the elimination of ISIS, and that he was basically just blowing smoke when he said that he was going to do it. He always had these two different sides of it, right? ISIS had to be destroyed, but they were a JV team. So either they're a JV team or they have to be destroyed. And he basically went with the JV team and I think basically has operated under a strategy that I would guess Hillary Clinton will operate under also, which is that ISIS will pose a threat, and we will absorb a certain amount of ISIS activity in the United States and in Europe, rather than do the incredibly dirty work of getting rid of them. So if that means an Orlando every year, or a Paris every year, or, you know, something like that, better that than the full-on elimination. No politician can say that out loud. And in fact, in some ways, it's a serious policy. That is to say, it's the thing that cannot be said, but is, if you look at, if you really want to be realpolitik about it, you say, you know, 50 to 100,000 troops, you know, a commitment of a small war in this place where we have no real hope of doing anything other than stemming the bloodshed in Syria and eliminating, which both of which are incredibly valuable things to do, but the United States doesn't have the heart or the will to do them in the way that they would need to be done. So here the United States, here's your choice. You know, do it and suffer the consequences of it, or don't do it and suffer the consequences of it. There's no good answer. No politician will say that. But I think Trump in particular has put himself in an interesting cage and box that we'll see how he, you know, manages to squirm through if he is really pressed on it in the three debates and in what goes on over the next 2 months.
You know, Obama, of course, hasn't come out and said, you know, yes, as you said, we'll sort of we'll absorb the ISIS attacks as a price for not getting involved in a real war against them. But what he has said is that he's very proud of the fact that he's bucked the sort of conventional foreign policy wisdom, because up until he came to office, U.S. foreign policy establishment would sort of go out on a limb, go too far, and then lock us into these shows of bravado. And he, in fact, calls reneging on his red line in Syria the proudest moment of his presidency.
Which, again, following the logic, if he were a true realpolitiker, if he were a truly, you know, a person who viewed narrow American interests with dispassionately and without a moral framework as the responsible way to govern policy, an argument can be made for that. That is to say that we're not responsible for the fact that Assad and the Syrians are going at each other and that there are 250,000 dead and that all of that has happened, that is their problem. We have no interest in that area. And what's more, if Europe, if Germany has made this terrible mistake to open its borders because of, you know, the sad images of Syrians fleeing in leaky boats and people drowning, that's not our problem either. Our narrow national interest involves securing our homeland and securing our interests, and there's no oil in Syria, and there's no this, and there's no that. But he doesn't, of course, say that. In the end, he will be the most cold-blooded American foreign policy leader since I don't even know who. I mean, you could say Nixon, but even Nixon, I think, Nixon and Kissinger, but even Nixon and Kissinger weren't quite as cold about this. You know, you don't sit there and watch an entire region immolate largely because you decided not to properly negotiate the status of forces agreement in Iraq and thus created this vacuum that allowed this evil thing to mushroom.
And then, of course, the challenge to it, even on realpolitik terms, is are we really being served by this? Because as we now see, things like his reneging on the red line, his being pushed around on the Iran nuclear deal, these are having global consequences for the U.S. in terms of stature and its ability to influence events.
Right, which we saw last week and the week before. He made this was supposed to make this triumphant sweep through Asia, his last major foreign trip as president. Finally, the Asian pivot was at the center and the forefront of things, and then these ridiculous things happened on his trip. The government of China got all pissy about the staircase that had been flown by the United States to the landing field that he would ordinarily come down, and insisted that their staircase be used rather than his because the Secret Service couldn't communicate with the Chinese driver who was going to drive the staircase up to the plane, up to Air Force One. And so Obama instead came down the rear staircase of Air Force One, something that he only does when there is a security risk involved. And so the Chinese were deeply offended. But of course, flies there, and the fact that they don't say, do whatever you're the president of the United States, do whatever you want with your stupid staircase, with your stupid plane staircase that you flew here before, you know, because you don't trust our staircase. You don't trust our staircase, fine. We understand. You're America. That's you know, we want to make nice with you. So they didn't do that. Then, of course, there was the absolutely hilarious thing that happened with the president of the Philippines, Duterte, where Duterte, because Obama said, yeah, I'm going to take up the fact that he's, you know, he should expect that I'm going to have some questions about his human rights record in fighting this drug war in the Philippines, whereupon Duterte, upon hearing this, called him either a son of a whore or a son of a bitch or something like that. Or I think son of a whore is supposed to mean son of a bitch in Tagalog. So it's not as bad as saying son of a whore in other languages.
Right.
But
and, you know, the Philippines is an ally. It's a U.S. ally.
It's a U.S. ally. I mean, you know, it's by the way, the interesting thing about about this whole thing is, so there is this guy, Duterte, becomes politician. The drugs are just like, you know, they're having a terrible drug problem in the Philippines, and he's elected by a plurality in May or something like that, because he says he's gonna basically take it to the drug dealer. Thousands of people are gonna die, according to him, fighting this to kill off these drug lords and to end it. And this is what he wants to do. And he's called something like the Jackal. He's got the Punisher. He's got some like crazy cartoon nickname. This guy, and then he now has a 91% approval rating in the Philippines, having been elected, I think, by 40, but with a margin of 44%, because They like his tough talk, and apparently they don't mind that he called the president of the United States son of a whore. So so there's more for your argument that Obama has the American standing has worsened to some degree under Obama.
And there are also...
I mean, look, someone threw a shoe, at Bush in Iraq, but that was like it was like a guy in a room throwing a shoe at him.
Right. And,
it wasn't the president of the Philippines throwing a shoe at him.
Not only that, but there are also deeper, more substantive problems that we're having around the world. I mean, not only are the Chinese obstructing his deplaning, but... they're not listening to us when we ask them to stop dredging up and creating islands in the South China Seas and infringing on the sea lanes of our allies, you know.
Well, of course not.
Iran is now regularly harassing U.S. sailors in the Persian Gulf. You know, these are also the wages of laying back and bucking the foreign policy consensus.
Yeah, but, you know, Iran is not only... harassing our sailors and detaining them, and these things are happening. But as there is the steady drip of revelations over the past 3 weeks that Iran has not in fact destroyed all of this excess uranium that was supposedly going to be destroyed in the wake of the Iran deal, but has kept a third of it in storage so that it can maintain it. It hasn't spiked it. It hasn't sent it off to be, you know, denuclearize it or de-yellow cake it or whatever it is happens. This fissionable material that's already been created, and all of these secret side deals that are being sort of coming out moment by moment that being revealed by our friend Omri Sarin at the Israel Project, and John Solomon, the reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and you know, it's just astounding. The Iran deal was a catastrophe. We believe the Iran deal was a catastrophe as it was, and assumed that they would cheat later. Not that there were side deals that allowed them to cheat while the deal was being implemented.
Right, right. There were side deals, the details of which we don't know. But point to the idea that the U.S. would let the Iranians slip on the demands of the deal, essentially.
Right, and then treat and then be incredibly provocative toward the U.S. Navy, which is the other striking part. So that basically, whatever idea Obama had, which was the secondary idea of the Iran nuclear deal, that it would bring Iran into line with the more rational, civilized communities of the world. It would enmesh it in Western capitalist structures and international economic structures, and that it would therefore have this incentive to behave well over the course of the decade, and then maybe that would be the decade in which Iran would somehow come to see reason about its irredentist and millenarian ambitions, including its existential threat to Israel. And obviously, the idea was the minute that this happened, the Iranians were going to say, "Oh yeah, that's what you think." You know, we're going to behave in ways that at other times would have forced you to go to war with us, or shoot one of our planes down, or bomb one of our boats or allow one of our boats to fire on your boat because it was coming too close.
And this will all happen while Iran will be enmeshed in international markets now,
right.
And we'll they'll reap all the benefits, but the behavior won't change.
Right. So it's really a great time for America. I think we can agree. It's a really thrilling moment to look at the leadership that we have now and the leadership that we're about to have. This choice between the two most unpopular people ever to run for the presidency. And as I said earlier, you know, the funny thing is that the vote has to add up to 100%. So we find ourselves. I'm sorry, by the way, for the sirens going down Broadway. That's one of the problems of this raw form known as podcasting. We don't sit in a in a nice studio with, you know, all enmeshed with soundproofing and all of that. We can't afford it and we don't do it. And so you get some taste of what it's like to work in our offices here in the Garment District.
Yeah, this is our that stuff's for the elite.
That's right. We're part of the, you know. I know they. This is what, you know. All the Trump people look at us and say, you know, we're going to wonderful cocktail parties and, you know, high stepping out with people like that. But in fact, we
podcast amid sirens.
Another funny little detail about our offices, which I don't think I've ever mentioned on this podcast, is that we are two floors above Al Sharpton's National Action Network. So this building that we're in contains multitudes, everybody. So tonight is a Commander-in-Chief's Forum. I think Matt Lauer is presiding, in which first Hillary and then Donald Trump will be asked military questions and all sorts of military questions. And he's already telegraphed what he's going to say. What's interesting about Hillary Clinton is that there's a general perception, I think, that she is more hawkish than Obama. I mean, we know she is because we've heard she was for more military engagement. She was always in arguing for more military engagement in the world and use of the military during the Obama administration than the president was comfortable with. But it is funny that we're coming into this race with the perception being that Hillary is sort of more hawkish than Trump. And how hawkish can she actually really be? What do you think? I can't imagine that she's really...
No, you know, I mean, there are articles dating back, you know, I don't know, 5 years already saying that, you know, Hillary's some sort of secret neocon or sort of neocon light. I mean, that's not new. People, there's a lot of that kind of talk. No, I don't see it at all. I mean, you know, one thing I'd like, someone should ask her tonight or at some point, is to really sort of tease out from her, try to get her on record as where she disagrees with Obama on these things, where she would have been more hawkish,
right?
Particularly regarding Iraq and Syria. You know, did we leave in the right way? You know, if you ask her, should we have left? Well, she say yes, of course. That was a mistake. But did we leave responsibly? That was the plan. That was the watchword.
Well, there is no way that Hillary Clinton, who requires every bit of Barack Obama's persuasive powers with the parts of the Democratic coalition that she can muster to help her in November, who is going to disagree, you know, one jot or tittle with the Obama record. But it will be interesting to see her squirm. I mean, you know, speaking as you know, people who have made our distaste for the Republican nominee, I think, unambiguously clear over the last months and year. Nonetheless, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that a lot of liberal commentators and people have been, you know, very archly saying that, you know, the Republican Party summoned this upon themselves because nobody stopped Trump and there was no effort to stop Trump and it really didn't. Everybody was fighting among themselves and, you know, the GOP owns this and this is the result of traditions dating back and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so here's my question. Hillary Clinton, in March of 2015, gave that press conference in front of Picasso's Guernica at the UN, and this disastrous press conference in which she talked about the email scandal. We now know that 3 weeks, that it was around the time that, despite the fact that she said she wanted all the emails released, she or somebody simultaneously ordered that many of them should be destroyed. Where were the Democrats and liberals, serious Democrats and liberals, who said, you know what, she is really not fit to be the president. And we're going back to a time in which we have, you know, the Clinton era, the disgraces of the Clinton era are being revisited upon us, and we need to look at this very hard, including Barack Obama, who had sitting there his vice president, whom he could have drafted into service and running against Hillary. No one in the Democratic Party did this except Bernie Sanders, who was by definition not the person that you're looking for if you're saying, you know, this is really not the right person. So the fact that, you know, the right has gotten lectured on how it was so bad about stopping Trump and everything bad about him, and I would still like to know where were the Democratic Panjandra, aside from the really left-wing ones who didn't like her from the left, who said, we can't allow this Clinton disease to be visited upon America again.
Where were the never Hillarys?
Exactly. The Bernie bros, yeah, who didn't want this because they wanted socialism and thought that she was a corporate sellout, not that she was a sleaze. Right. And, you know, the single most significant moment probably in this entire presidential season for the Democrats was the moment at which Bernie Sanders said in that debate that he was sick and tired of hearing about her emails. Imagine that Bernie Sanders had, while he was prosecuting the case against Hillary for being, you know, insufficiently left-wing, had also said, we cannot go back to this. These people cannot be entrusted with the presidency again. I mean, say what you will about Barack Obama, you know, it is, and say what you will about the Fast and the Furious and all of this, you know, there are no financial irregularities surrounding the Obama administration, personal financial irregularities or fits of personal misbehavior and stuff that, you know, disgraces the Oval Office. And here we are, and with Hillary Clinton playing the role of key defender and blocking tackle in ensuring that her husband, despite her humiliation, stayed in office. So I just think it's an interesting irony of this election that Democrats who are now sitting there, I think, panicking at the thought that she may blow this,
right,
were simply too cowardly to oppose her in any systematic way.
Yeah, and I think there are also political health implications here, too, because during the primaries, people on the left love to say, look at the wreck that the right has become. Look, they're in a mess. They're fighting with each other. But in actuality, when you have a candidate like Trump out there, there's a sign of some vitality and health in the fact that he's being opposed by people.
Right.
It's arguably less healthy to never produce an anti-Hillary movement on the other side.
Right. Or you know, so Martin O'Malley. So there were the three of them on that stage. There was Martin O'Malley, there was Hillary, and there was Bernie Sanders. So Martin O'Malley never could get anything serious going. And Hillary was not compelled by circumstances in the election, in her primary season, to adjudicate and have to answer and deal with the emails as a political matter. It all fell now into the summer and in the fall. And if she loses, she's going to lose because of this. And the people who will be responsible for her being defeated are the Democrats who didn't look at her in March of 2015 and say, we better get Joe Biden in here or something like that, because otherwise this, you know, disaster is going to befall us. So with that in mind and with those thoughts, once again, we've come to the end of the Commentary Magazine podcast. Commentary Magazine closing in on the end of its 71st year as the most distinguished monthly magazine of analysis, opinion, cultural reflection, its purpose to defend the West and its institutions, to represent the best that has been thought and said in Western culture, to defend and stand up for the United States of America, and to stand as a bulwark against anti-Semitism and for the State of Israel. Please join us. CommentaryMagazine.com. If you get some free reads, then it's $19.99 to subscribe digitally. $29.95 gets you our iPad app and our beautiful monthly magazine, which comes in your mailbox toward the end of every month. We're just closing another issue right now with a lot of interesting stuff, including the first epic poem that I think we've ever published. So, and I'm not kidding. So join us there. Join us next week. I think Noah Rothman will be back. Thank you to Abe and to Leah Rahmani Goodstein.
Greenberg,
excuse me. our newly married Leah Greenberg here. Are one of our great staffers who is serving as our substitute radio producer in place of Noah. She just got married, so you have to excuse me for not remembering her married name or confusing it with a different Jewish name. And we will see you again next week.